This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I tried to come up with a Will Smith joke, but I just couldn't think of a punchline. My co-host is John Passon, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and his favorite knight of the round table is Circumference. In this episode, John and I will discuss what you need to be aware of when learning from native speakers. Interviews with Nicholas Hung, who went the extra mile to reconnect with his roots. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Passon. I'm in Shanghai, China. I'm in the middle of this whole crazy COVID lockdown nonsense. How's it going?
All right, before we kick off today, we have a listener question. And this comes from Zach from Sydney, Australia. Thanks, Zach. He says, I have a question about when you should deviate your learning towards the content you're more interested in and away from the standard textbook course. I'm a physiotherapist. I would like to be able to speak to my Chinese clients in Mandarin, and so would need to learn specific phrases, vocab, and medical jargon for that. Do you suggest getting to a certain proficiency or progress through the HSK courses before deviating towards your own specific learning? Thanks very much. All right, Zach, I really appreciate that question. And John, you've got a great perspective on this.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing I deal with a lot. Yes, you do want to get a basic foundation. And the thing about most languages, Chinese included, is that in the beginning, everyone needs to learn the same thing. Everyone needs to learn four tones. Everyone needs to learn pinyin. And then there comes a point when you want to start specializing. So that's the question. When is the point, right? And I would say it's somewhere around the intermediate level. So probably after HSK 3, HSK is not my favorite standard, but I would say after HSK 3, at a low level, everything you learn is business Chinese. Everything you learn is medical Chinese. You got to learn the basics. But once you get to the intermediate level, after HSK 3 or so, then you can start specializing, and you definitely want to.
And to add to that a little bit, it's mainly about getting that foundation in, right? If you have a good foundation, then you can build whatever house you want on top of it. And it's following your interests. So if this is what's going to really keep you motivated, if this is your goal, your reason for learning Chinese, absolutely. And we're always talking about study the things that are most relevant to you. How do you want to use your Chinese? So, I mean, really, Zach, this is an excellent case of, yeah, get that good foundation in, learn all the basics, build a good foundation, and then just follow your interests because that's what, how you plan on using your Chinese. So definitely learn how you're going to use it.
And it's good that you know that because not everybody knows how they want to use it. So you got a clear goal, get that intermediate foundation, and then go for it. Okay, so guys, today we want to talk about something that is very important for every language, and I feel like it's especially important for Chinese. We're talking about the importance of native speakers in your learning. And I think we all kind of have a clue that you want native speakers in your learning. They're a good thing, of course. But there are also some aspects where they can complicate issues, maybe even accidentally do stuff that's not helpful. So that's what we want to talk about today.
Yes, this is definitely an issue for every language. But for a lot of reasons, this is a little more pronounced in Chinese.
Yeah, so in Chinese, you have issues like, you know, whether you want Beijing-centric or Shanghai-centric or, you know, Taiwan-centric Mandarin. And then you have massive difference between different generations. And then you have, you know, of course, you have characters and tones. And it does feel like certain native speakers can lead you astray by accident more easily in Chinese compared to some other languages.
It's good to give a little analogy. There's this story of, you know, two fish in a fishbowl, and one fish says to the other, hey, water's nice today. The other fish, like, looks around and is like, what's water? So it's one of these things of oftentimes when you're a native speaker, we're not even aware of our own language, and frequently we're unaware of our own culture.
And so it's one of the things, like if someone asks you about your language, sometimes it's hard to explain why something is the way it is. So it's hard to explain a rule. Someone asks you, like, why do we say it this way? And it's kind of, I don't know. It's just the way we do it. And you never really think about it. Same with culture. It's just sometimes there's just those things about culture, which it's just part of your life. You don't really think about it. And so it's like a fish swimming in water, and you're not really even aware of what it is that you're in.
And so when you ask a native speaker a question, you know, like, what's the difference between this word and this other very similar word? They're typically not going to know, and they'll think about it, and they'll do their best to answer it, but it's not something they ever thought about before. So the first thought that comes to mind that seems plausible, they're going to give you that, and they feel like that's probably better than anything you could have come up with on your own because they're a native speaker. But it might not be very correct. It might not hold up under a broad survey of the language, or it might not go very deep. There definitely are cases when you ask a non-teacher a linguistic question involving subtle differences between words, and they'll just give you some random crap. That definitely happens.
I'd like to point out that this is a good reason why linguistics is a whole branch of study. John, you have a master's in linguistics, right?
Hmm.
Because language is a lot more than just learning how to speak it and teach it and learn it and all that stuff. I mean, linguistics is just about the language, right? There are some questions and things about language which we probably never really became aware of until people really started studying this area of linguistics.
Yeah, and the key word here is metalinguistic awareness. So how much do you know objectively looking in on the language? And if you're not a student of linguistics, you tend to get kind of caught up in like, oh, I'm a native speaker, I have to know this. But if you have experience, if you have training in linguistics, you kind of look at it as just like natural phenomenon, and you're observing, and you're like, have I observed that? Have I not observed that? And you're a bit more objective, and you can give less biased information about the language. And a lot of native speakers don't have that. They're too busy swimming around in the water. They don't ever, get out of the water and look down at the water. So that's where linguistic training can really help. And most teachers do have this kind of linguistic training, especially if they have, a higher degree in teaching. But, you're going to deal with lots of native speakers that don't have a whole lot of metalinguistic awareness, and they have varying degrees of, understanding of their native tongue.
On that note, John, this is a little bit what this podcast is about, right? We're not teaching you Chinese. We're talking about learning Chinese. So there's definitely that linguistic slant. I think after listening to this for a while, you're going to come away with a lot of that awareness that we're even talking about.
So let's get into another aspect that I think affects a lot of native speakers when they try to help someone learning their language, and that's one of regionalism. So I'd like to give my own example. When I first came to China, I was an English teacher in Hangzhou. And, as an American, I had plenty of great English to teach these Chinese kids. I know the British love this. And like one of the things I did was I taught them better greetings, because all anyone ever said was like, hello, how are you? And I was having none of that. So I wanted them to have some more updated greetings. So I taught them stuff like, how are you doing? How is it going? And some of them would say, how are you going? And I was like, no, it's how is it going, or how are you doing? How is it going? How are you doing? How are you going is wrong. All right. And I didn't know at the time that that's actually correct English in, I guess, the UK and Australia. And so I was just telling them it was totally wrong. And so this was, being an American, not having any experience in the UK or Australia or other places that use these expressions, I could only teach them from my own limited viewpoint, my own personal experience with the language.
You're bringing a bunch of things to mind, John. I was in England for a couple of years. One area in Derby, they say, hey up me duck, hey up me duck. But, if you say that outside of Derby, it was like, it'll give you a weird look. And some people might say, oh, you're from Derby. But yeah, there's all sorts of things like that in the States here, like what's good, versus what's up. And they won't necessarily use those as interchangeably in different areas. So there's definitely aspects of this all over China. I like to think of it, it's almost as diverse as the food is.
Yeah. And sometimes people use something that's like kind of an exception, and they don't realize it's an exception in the rest of China. Or sometimes they speak normal Mandarin, and they're just not aware of some of the exceptions out there that aren't that uncommon, you will actually encounter. They're just not aware of it because it's outside their limited experience. And that's just something that happens.
Now, this is very anecdotal, John, but one trip I had out to Sichuan province, I was just chatting with someone there and trying to get a better understanding of like the local dialect that they had in their area. And so she was saying some things in, I guess it was Sichuanese, but it sounded like Mandarin with different tones. And then as I paid a little closer attention, it seemed like her Mandarin, some of her tones were a little different than what I had expected. Now, like I said, this is very anecdotal. I'm not going to try to project this on all of Sichuanese, but there's definitely going to be impacts like that where your maybe the local dialect or what they grew up speaking or speaking at home is going to be different than standard Mandarin, which is going to be used, you know, in the workplace and at school, and there's going to be influences in that way.
And since you bring up standard Mandarin, that's another thing that's actually quite interesting about Chinese, I think, which is some people have like this fixation on, you know, what's in the dictionary is what's correct. And I don't care what anyone else says. Mm-hmm. Maybe everyone says it that way, but they're all wrong. So in linguistics, we call this prescriptivism. There is a right way. And if you don't say it the right way, you're wrong. Whereas the more, you know, scientific, empirical way of looking at the language is descriptivism. And this is what people actually say. And we should probably learn what people actually say because you want to understand people when you're out there in the world and not just reading a dictionary. But when it comes to Chinese, there are so many words that have like multiple pronunciations. In some cases, everyone pronounces it one way, but the dictionary says it's wrong. In other cases, most people pronounce it like the dictionary, but some people pronounce it in a way that's, you know, not like the dictionary. And so there's just a lot of variety. I call these pronunciation variants, especially as you get to higher levels, you'll come across these.
This reminds me, John, when I was growing up in school, I had a teacher who was always like, you know, ain't a word because ain't's not in the dictionary. But that's not the case, right? Language, essentially, it's a tool, right? We use to communicate. And I would argue that if you say words and the other person understands your meaning and intent, then you've successfully communicated, even if those words don't happen to be in the dictionary.
Yeah, totally. And so the whole game is trying to strike this balance between like getting enough knowledge of this broad landscape that is the Chinese language, you know, different accents and regionalisms and different generations speaking different ways. You know, you got to get some of that from all these different aspects of the language, but you also can't become an expert in every tiny little niche, you know, speaker community. So it's just something that you have to work at, like, as you get better and better at Chinese, you just have to keep this in mind, and you have to work at it a little bit, and you have to get information from native speakers, but you don't want to get information from just one native speaker. You want to get it from a variety of native speakers so you get a fuller picture.
You know, and just to point out that this may be less relevant for you, depending on what your situation is. Mm. If you are in China, traveling around the country all the time, doing whatever, then this is obviously going to be more of an issue, right? Because you're going to encounter a lot of these things. But I think what it's really good is keep this in mind, because there have been instances where I've been here in America, I've encountered different native speakers, and I've heard them say things in different ways. Now, because I was living in China for a long time, I was aware that, oh, it seems like, you know, they've got an accent that's more like this way, or it seems like it's from this region. Or I know that the more standard way might be to say it this way, and they were saying it a different way. But if you don't have that depth of experience in China, it's just being aware that just because you heard someone say it one way, that may not be the most widely accepted way to say it. Yeah, it may be good to get a variety of perspectives. And of course, dictionaries are helpful to kind of reference some of this stuff, because sometimes you may even look up a word that someone had sent to you or said. And for example, in Pleiko, they have some words that are denoted like, oh, these are like the regional, or, you know, this might be exclusive to Taiwan.
But dictionaries, they tend to be pretty behind when it comes to Chinese. Pleiko does a pretty good job, but even Pleiko, like, there are plenty of words where they use the standard pronunciation, but then what people actually say can be quite different. So that's not something you need to worry about as a beginner. Like, honestly, do not worry about this as a beginner. But once you get to kind of upper intermediate levels, it's something you have to keep your eyes open for.
And I think the last part on this topic, John, is that it's really impossible to know the whole language. And so I'll just put this out, you know, for English, how many words are there in the language? There's something like 20 or 30,000, 50,000. There's probably more than 50,000. But an educated native speaker of a language will know 9 to 10,000 words. So if you just put it that way, like as far as English goes, I'm like, maybe I only know, you know, a fifth of the language. And when you put it that way, that sounds surprisingly small.
And so when you're kind of building your community of people that you talk to in Chinese and about Chinese, you're also kind of forming this patchwork of different types of speakers, and they kind of cover different domains. And if they're from different parts of China, different generations, then you're covering a broader range of, you know, types of language. But if they're all from, you know, the same hometown and they're roughly the same age, then, you know, it is going to be limited. And it's not like your goal has to be to cover everything, right? And as Jared's saying, it's impossible to cover everything. But it is just something to keep in mind as you expand your studies, like how broad do you want to be? I know people who have done all their studies in Beijing and they've studied Beijinghua and they just love it. And they go to Shanghai and they don't understand a whole bunch of stuff, but they don't care because they just love Beijing. And that's okay too, right? Obviously. If they just stay out of Shanghai,
yeah,
we don't need you here.
This is something that I'm always amazed about. I'm a very curious person, and I like to hear about people's jobs, their industries, their careers, things like that. Whenever I've really delved into some other new industry, it's amazing how much like terminology and concepts are unique to a specific industry. And I would counter that same thing in Chinese. I have maybe a little wider repertoire of baking Chinese because my wife and I had opened a bakery in Shanghai. So there's a lot of words that I wouldn't expect a second language learner to know. And I think this relates even to that listener question we had at the beginning. I was like, hey, when should I branch off and start studying how I want to use the language? And I'm like, yeah, go for it. And when it comes to a native speakers are going to be able to help you learn some of that things. If you really want to be focused in an area and they have the experience in that area, then they can teach you things that you probably aren't going to be able to learn from a book.
Yeah, and this is one of my favorite things about my job because I work with multiple teachers from different parts of China. So whenever we get together and we talk about, you know, linguistic issues, usually stuff that relates to things that different clients have brought up in their studies, getting these perspectives, you know, different ages and specifically different regions of China. Sometimes they relate it to their own dialects, their Fangyan, and sometimes they relate it to, you know, literature or whatever. But it's just fascinating, and it's one of the things that makes the language more interesting for me personally.
I just love how deep the language can be, and you know, there's always going to be something to learn. Even if you're a native speaker, there's always new things to learn. There's new characters. There's no end to the learning. But you don't have to let that discourage you either. But the great thing is about really if you're able to engage with native speakers, it is going to open up new aspects of the language that you wouldn't be able to, like I said, you can't learn in a book, and that you're going to be able to learn a lot of new things.
Yeah, and one thing I want to leave everyone with is this idea that no single native speaker is infallible. You know, no one knows everything about their own language. And so don't try to get all of your information about Chinese from one native speaker. Just make sure you diversify a bit in terms of native speakers. You'll definitely benefit from that.
And you can learn Chinese. Now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Manner Companion, Graded Readers.
Today we're talking about The Secret Garden, Mimi Huayuan. It's our Manner Companion, level 1, graded reader, using only 300 basic characters.
This is a classic story originally set in England, but we took it and we put it in Nanjing, China. We totally localized it. We adapted it to a Chinese setting. It's a beautiful story, and it works really well as a graded reader.
And this is a story that's special to my heart, and I'm sure yours too, John. This was our first graded reader we'd ever published in the Manner Companion series. And it is today, it is still one of our best-selling ones because it's such a great story.
Well, we did pick it as the first one because it's such a good story.
Absolutely. And readers seem to agree. And we have tons of reviews, hundreds of reviews on this one.
And that is the point of a graded reader. It has to be a good story, right? You want it to be at your level, but you want a good story.
That's right. So if you want to read a good story, pick up The Secret Garden today. It's a Manner Companion, level 1 graded reader. Secret Garden, you can find it on Kobo, iBooks, Amazon, or wherever you get your books, hopefully.
Enjoy.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rant. Yeah.
You sure about that? You sound like rant.
Yeah, I had to remember. Now, it would be easier to rant about lockdown in Shanghai, but actually my rant is about, I don't even know what it's called. It's not pollen. It's the stuff that falls from the trees in Shanghai in the spring. And you can accidentally inhale it, and it makes you, you know, hack up a lung, coughing it out. And I just got in my eye today. This stuff just, this like yellowish, orangish dust just falling from the trees. You know, Shanghai's pretty cool.
I wonder, but, I think it is pollen.
This is annoying.
Or is it, I don't know. We have cottonwood trees out here in Utah, and you kind of get that stuff. But I know it's not the same. I'm trying to think what that stuff is. But yeah, it gets all up in your face.
Yeah, like... spring is so nice, except for this. All right. Anyway, that's a pretty lame little rant, but, you know, that's what I got today. What do you got, Jared? Rant or rave?
Oh, I got a rant. This is just all straight negative today. All right. So this one's good. So here, you know, we have Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A is a, you know, real popular fast food chain here in the United States. I think they're international as well. But they recently released some multicultural flashcards that are going with, like, the kids' meals. So they have 5 flashcard sets, and one of them is Chinese. And I was clued into this by Miss Sean Fan. She's a Chinese teacher in California. These Chinese flashcards, okay, so there are a number of them. I think about like half of them are okay, but the rest of them, oh my gosh, they're cringe. Okay, there's 2 specific which are terrible. All right, so they have 1 flashcard here for Chi Che car. But they have the pronunciation on it, Tita. Really? Seriously? That's like not even close. Chicha, Tita. And then they have another one which is for Qing, which is, you know, like please. And it's Ting instead of Qing. And they've kind of redone their own pinyin. So they, instead of shui, there's sui. Instead of xie xie, it's sei sei or something. I don't know. It's pretty bad. And it's like, they had some sort of company that does flashcards to do this stuff. And I'm like, how can you get this wrong? I'm boggled by this, John.
Well, I think it might be one of these native speaker issues, right? Someone's like, oh, I'm a native speaker. I'll just, you know, give you an easy to pronounce version. And they bungled it.
Yeah, bungled it pretty bad. It's just seriously, come on. You guys could have done better. It's not hard.
Shame on
Google
you,
Translate
Chick-fil-A.
Would have
Shame.
Done better. Shang on Chick-fil-A. Worldwide Buddies, evidently, is the company that produced these for them. But, I mean, seriously, come on. Proofreading. We do proofreading, right, John?
We do. I know. An occasional
error. We are a publishing company.
May make it through the checks, but we do lots of proofreading. Lots.
That's right. So, hey, Chick-fil-A, you want to get these made next time? Give us a call.
So hi everybody, my name is Nick, or Nicholas Hung. I was born and raised out here in the West Coast, Los Angeles. I went to undergrad at Occidental College, and then I went and studied at the National Taiwan Normal University, and then I went to Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and got my master's in international studies.
No matter where you start on your language journey, it takes effort and work to get where you want to go, of which Nick's story is an excellent example to all of us. Stay with us. All right, Nick, why did you start learning Chinese?
My family, we are ethnically Chinese, or Taiwanese, depending on who you ask. And so my parents, especially my mom, she is an artist, so she knows how to do calligraphy art. And so culture and language was a really big part of our lives. And so when we were kids, she would say in the house, 讲英文假装听不懂, which means if you speak English, I'm gonna pretend that I don't understand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she figured that, you know, you're out there taking classes in English, what are you going to do to keep your Chinese up to date? And as a heritage learner, it's the typical story, right? Where you go and your parents sign you up for a Chinese school on Sundays and you kind of go through it. And then you're like, but mom, you know, the weather's nice outside. I don't want to be in a classroom. So you kind of go through that for a couple years and then you stop. Maybe your mom or your dad tries to teach you and you're like, mom, dad, you're not my teacher, right? And so you kind of let that fall to the side. But I guess I was lucky because I always thought that I would want to do international studies or politics. And so learning Chinese felt to me not only a way to engage with my culture, but also to apply it in the real world.
Well, maybe you could frame that up for us a little bit, because I started learning Chinese when I was 30 years old. And I think about, wow, what if I had started learning like a kid?
Yeah.
You know, when I was in school or things like that. So you said your mom said, speak Chinese to me. I assume she did speak English, right? But she wouldn't respond or pretend she didn't understand you if you spoke in English. So how do you feel like your Chinese developed during that period?
It's an interesting thought, right? Obviously, language is practiced, right? And it's something that needs to be applied. And so, to be completely honest, I didn't read or write Chinese when I was younger. It was only after I went to take classes in Taiwan before I could actually read. I mean, when I was a kid, we would learn zuying fu hao. So in Taiwan, we use something that most people call bopa mofa. Formally, it's called zuying fu hao. And it's just a different alphabet.
For our listeners, it's like pinyin, but it's a different form.
Right.
Kind of.
And so the joke is that when I was a kid, I would know how to use the zuying fu hao. And that was enough to kind of cheat, right? You know, on your cell phones or when you're typing words, you just try to sound it out in your brain and then you type out the words and then the words appear. But the problem there is, from a speaking perspective, I would speak to my aunts, my uncles, you know, my parents and so on, and they would say, oh, your Chinese is pretty good for an ABC, right? An American-born Chinese. But figures of speech, for example, or interesting grammatical structures, you know, they're lost to me. Mm-hmm. So colloquially, my Chinese was pretty good, but reading and writing, not up to par. And so maybe I've had 20 more years of experience speaking, but all that means is that maybe my pronunciation is a little bit closer. But trust me, if I go to Taiwan or mainland China, people, they'll say, oh, are you from Malaysia or Singapore?
Oh, really?
Yeah, you look Chinese, but there's something a little amiss. And so when I tell them, oh, yeah, I'm actually an ABC, then they're like, oh,
there
it is.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I think that's great to hear, because sometimes it's really easy as, I guess, non-Asian to look at someone who grew up speaking Chinese and just be like, oh, yeah, you should be fluent, right? It should become easy to you. But it sounds like maybe you were conversational a little bit, but you had to learn your characters. That's what I'm kind of hearing from you, is that the literacy aspect was not your strong suit. And maybe you lack that depth of sophistication in the language.
Yeah, and that's why I think there is a benefit to taking formal classes, or in the case of the show, to have somebody to work through that with you, right? To give you something to read, because you could just try and buy like a textbook and try to work through it yourself. But having somebody who can not only kind of point you in the right direction, but then also tell you, this is how you pronounce these things, right? Because Chinese specifically is a tonal language, and the characters are not related to the pronunciation like in English. So having a little bit of structure is good. At the same time, as a heritage speaker, there is one benefit. And that is when the teacher says, oh, this is the character for, I don't know, like zhong. In my brain, I can connect that. Oh, now I know what that character is. And so now I can match a face to the name, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, I think with enough time and practice, anybody can learn Chinese.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Well, I also like to hear a little bit, like, where do you think your motivation changed? Okay, because what you shared with me is a real common story. You know, you're growing up, parents are speaking Chinese, you speak Chinese in the home. Some kids are very reluctant to speak it.
Yeah.
You're forced to go to those Chinese classes on the weekend. I mean, I have yet to have an ABC friend who did not go to those weekend Chinese classes, right? And some people really resent it, some people do really well, and some people are in between. But at what point did you kind of decide, well, hey, I want to take this seriously. I really want to learn this language because
there are a lot of individuals that don't, right?
That
maybe it's just feel like it's kind of, you're obligated to speak, you're obligated to learn. But where, what point did you decide, I want to really learn this? And what was that trigger for you?
On one level, it's a cultural thing, right? In the U.S., having, of course, an American identity is one thing. But also to be able to be in touch with my ethnic background was really important to me. I have friends who their parents speak to them in English, period. They said that you already look different. I don't want you to sound different, right? My parents came over during the 80s, for example. If you came a little bit earlier, maybe there wasn't that community, right? And so people were like, well, you're going to assimilate. For my parents, since they came a little bit later and the community was kind of established, they moved out to Los Angeles, you know, Monterey Park, San Gabriel Valley, a lot of Chinese, Taiwanese, you know, diaspora. They were able to hold on to their language. And so I can speak to my grandparents in Mandarin, which is a blessing because I have friends who can't. My grandparents also speak Taiwanese. And so admittedly, my parents still have to do a little bit of translation, but being able to engage with them is very valuable. So East Asia has always been really important to me. And so when I was in college, I studied politics with a slight emphasis in East Asia. You know, I still have family in Taiwan and in China. And so I kind of looked in that direction for my future prospects. And one idea has always been to be a foreign service officer in the State Department. And if I get sent to China, the Shanghai consulate or AIT, that would be great. So part of me was always thinking, well, I could engage and also utilize the language that I already kind of have. And if I polish it up a little bit more, then it'll be enough to be professional.
Oh, that's great. A little bit of a motivation on the career aspect, right? I could really use this for my career, for my future life.
Yeah.
I can also imagine that you could have been easy to say, all right, I can speak Chinese. And, you know, I'm taking maybe some Chinese classes here and there at college. And maybe I'm going to do a bunch of flashcards and I'll start reading some books. And maybe that'll be good enough.
Yeah.
But why did you decide to, hey, let's really take this to the next level and say, I'm really going to dive in?
Well, the simplest answer is that you need to have that environment. I was lucky my parents could provide that environment for me. But in the cases of our listeners who might not necessarily have that environment, I highly recommend taking an opportunity to just go. Because language is more than just moving your mouth the right way or being able to read characters. It's also about the culture and about understanding where those things come from, right? Forget about the classic example of, well, the Chinese language is, they're pictograms, right? And so they represent real life objects.
Which is true sometimes.
Right, sometimes, sometimes. But I wanted to go and study from the people who live and breathe that. And it was an opportunity for me to get in touch with my roots. I have family in Taiwan, and so I wanted to go to Taiwan. And they have a great program. You can go to either National Taiwan University or you can go to National Taiwan Normal University. And then they have programs especially for heritage speakers like myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they don't focus so much on pronunciation. They assume that you know the Sunday school Chinese, and then they can start working on practical and applicable Chinese. And so that's why I initially chose to go to National Taiwan Normal University. When it came to my master's program, though, Hopkins Nanjing was an opportunity to go to China. You know, we still have family there on the mainland. And I've never really had a chance to engage with that side of history. And then you're taking master's level courses from Nanjing professors where you're writing a 3,000 character essay for class.
Zoinks.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Coming from somebody who a couple years ago had no idea what characters looked like, for example, to going to that, you know, it was a huge deal. But then you got to kind of be immersed, you know, absorb it in your daily life. And I think that that's valuable.
Yeah, I've heard that program. It's like pretty serious. It's like the real deal, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think they opened maybe during the 80s. You know, the opening up to the West was still very, very new. And this was back when you would get off of the airplane, go to the train station, and the only way that you could get Chinese money is some shady guy comes up and says, hey, you've got U.S. dollars, I've got renminbi, right?
Yeah, I had one of those guys back in Shanghai, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. And what happened was very early on, they got permission from Nanjing University to build this little campus. It's tiny. It's a couple buildings. It's on the corner of a couple of streets. And they had academic freedom and also the ability to stay on campus. And then they also got a bunch of professors from the Nanjing University proper to serve as professors there. And that is a rare opportunity. You're in a mixed environment where you have international students and mainland Chinese students. And you live there and you eat together and you take classes and struggle together. It's a little bit different than other programs because sometimes you go to a program where it's just university, blah, 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 in China. And the professors are all American professors. And you speak English and write your essays in English. And it's a different experience, not to downplay that. But Hopkins Nanjing Center was one of the places where it was very, very stressed, that connection with the language.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think were some of your most challenging aspects, even relating to learning Chinese at this point?
It's a classic conundrum, I think, is that my Chinese, since it was built upon colloquial person-to-person communication, when I was at the center, I would write essays the same way that I would write them in English, right?
Mm.
You would kind of formulate the sentence in your head, and then you would type the words down. But because of the fact that I had that informal structure, my essays, I would get some critique from professors saying, this is too colloquial.
Mm.
It's like I'm reading a conversation instead of reading an essay.
Interesting.
And I could never figure out how to get over that because somebody who, going back to a more formal education, would learn the proper grammar structures, right? To kind of upgrade your language beyond just conversational, right? And so my conversational Chinese made it seem like if it was in English, I would be writing an essay where I would be saying, in this essay, I'm going to talk about topic Y, and this is why you should trust me.
Yeah.
Instead of the more academic, like, in this essay, my thesis is of three parts, and so on and so forth. And that was one big challenge, right, which is to formalize my Chinese.
Now, that's really interesting. What were some other ways you found that maybe your English had influenced your Chinese, but maybe you didn't quite realize it?
Chinese, what is it? It's subject, object, verb.
I never think of it, though. I just use it, you know?
Right.
But you're right. It's something like it. It's a little different, right?
Yeah, yeah. So in Chinese, for example, the subject is stressed in the end. It's kind of like Yoda, right? When you hear Yoda speak, that's actually that kind of Asian grammatical structure. So it's not, I went to the store. It's the store I went to, or something like that.
Store went to, I did. I understand. That's actually like Japanese, you know?
Right,
like
right.
That.
But the point is in Chinese, there is actually, for the most part, no real difference from English. I can still say the same sentence the same way that I would make the English sentence in my brain. But it's those 1% examples where somebody from, you know, mainland China or the Chinese diaspora who they've grown up speaking Chinese, they will say, you know, I get what you mean, but I don't know if I would say it that way, you know, and at that moment, they'll know, you're not from around here, are you?
You may look the part, but yeah.
And so that's another thing about having English as my primary language is that sometimes it'll sneak up on you because you'll form the sentence and then you understand it. But if it was a Chinese teacher in school, they would say you have to switch your subject and your object or something like that.
It sounds like going into it, you had some conversational Chinese, you know, you had some literacy, but now you really upped your game by going through some more really intensive Chinese love. So what kind of opened up for you since then?
So I studied Chinese following my undergrad. So before I graduated, I had a chance to go to Taiwan and study the 318 Sunflower Student Movement.
Tell me what that is. I'm not familiar with that.
This must have been, I think, 2008 or 2009, where students from the National Taiwan University and also from the 政治大学, which is the politics university, they stormed the legislative yuan.
Oh, wow.
And peacefully occupied it for something like 2 weeks.
Oh, I do remember hearing about this. So go on. Yes.
Yeah. They were protesting the black box of legislation, right? The sausage machine, as we like to call it. And
how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
A song about that in Hamilton. All right.
And so they were frustrated because a lot of the decisions were being made in what they considered behind closed doors, right? You know, a lot of decisions regarding mainland and Taiwanese relations that were being made. And so they wanted to protest. And so they managed to get in. And then they occupied it. You know, Taiwan is really a powerful example of a democracy, a very strong democracy in East Asia. And it was unheard of to have not only the civil engagement, but then also to have such an impact, right? I mean, back in the day, right, before recent events, we wouldn't have potentially seen that happen in our lifetimes here in the United States. And to compare the two events, things that have happened here and the things that have happened in Taiwan, it also serves as an interesting juxtaposition. The problem then is that I was trying to do research, right? But if you can't read Chinese, you're only limited to face-to-face interviews. And I was being severely limited by my own language skills.
Interesting.
But since learning formally how to speak Chinese, I was able to intern at the Kuomintang for a couple of months.
Oh.
The Nationalist Party in Taiwan.
That's interesting. So you interned with the Kuomintang, which in English we would say, what, the Kuomintang?
Yeah.
How do they bastardize that? What is it?
It's like... Well, that's funny because in Taiwan, they use Wade Giles.
Yeah.
And Wade Giles is based off of the KMT.
So if I didn't know no Chinese, I would know it as the Kuomintang?
Yeah, the Kuomintang, right.
Kuomintang, okay, all right.
Yeah.
So and that was the party that Chiang Kai-shek, I'm just going to anglicize this, right, was fighting against the communists in the Civil War during that period. So maybe just for listeners, just give us a little background. What is that party and what did you do there?
So to talk about the Kuomintang or the Kuomintang is to talk about Chinese history. And a long time ago, 1911, the Republic of China was founded by Chiang Kai-shek and Sun Yat-sen. And they believed in democracy and the idea that the Kuomintang will be the natural leaders of China. Civil war breaks out between the Kuomintang and the communists, which is then put on hold because of World War II. And when World War II is over, the fighting starts again.
Let's get back to fighting, right?
Yeah. And then the communists, they take over and they establish the People's Republic of China. And Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang flee to Taiwan, where they establish the government in exile. Then it goes to George Bush. And when the UN finally recognizes the People's Republic of China as the official government of China, and then the Republic of China becomes not really a country, but not really a sovereign entity, but they have their own president officially.
Needless to say, it's political. Just a little perspective to some people who may be a little bit unfamiliar with that recent history. So what were you doing there when you were interning with the KMT?
So the KMT, currently it's the opposition party of Taiwan.
So it would be like in America, here we got the Republicans and Democrats. So it's just it's one of the big political parties.
Right. And they have not necessarily a parliament, but the legislative yuan is semi-parliamentary in nature, where they have a bunch of different parties and they all kind of have their own followers and such. It is very similar to, in this case, right? Right now, the Democrats are in control, so they are the primary, right? And then the Republicans are the quote-unquote opposition. The Kuomintang, having this very long history of control in Taiwan, including Chiang Kai-shek and then Chiang Ching-kuo, his own son, right? They didn't have a direct democracy until Chiang Ching-kuo made it so in like the 80s or something. So long story short, the Kuomintang is still around and they're still holding up their own values. And I was working as a research assistant for the director of foreign media and international engagement. His name is Eric Huang, but that's what I was doing. And it just meant looking at newspapers and doing some research. And we had a press conference, for example, or we invited a whole bunch of the government representatives to a Lunar New Year tea ceremony with the chairperson, things like that.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty neat. I mean, if you're working with a large political party in any country, I imagine you had the opportunity to meet interesting people along the way.
Yeah. And for those of you who are a little bit more familiar with Taiwanese politics, the chairperson at the time was a woman named Hong Xiuzhu. She's this very, very small statured but very powerful presence woman. I think she was one of the first women leaders of the KMT, and her nickname was the Hot Pepper because she had this huge presence. And so it was at this chairperson's lunar tea ceremony, which we had invited all of these representatives to show up to, me being this young guy from the States, I have the same last name, Hong Xiuzhu.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I'm thinking, wow, this is a great opportunity because of the way that last names work. There's a real chance that we could be very distantly related. And so I go up to her and I'm like, oh my gosh, my family, we are Kuomintang supporters. And I know from your political escapades about how amazing you are. I'm so excited to meet you. In Chinese, there are so many terms for familial relations, right? Mm-hmm. Your sister's son.
Yes, yeah.
Your uncle's, your dad's brother.
It gets exponential the further out you go. Right. Right? Yeah.
And so I use a term in Taiwanese, right? Minanese or Hokkien, called a-m. And there's no really direct translation between the Taiwanese and Mandarin Chinese, but the Mandarin Chinese is bo-mu. Bo-mu is your father's older brother's wife.
Okay, wow. All right.
Right.
Father's older brother's wife. Got it.
And she looked at me as if I had just stabbed her in the heart. And she leans over and she very quietly mutters to herself, this person can't speak Chinese, can he? In Chinese. And I'm like, I'm confused at why this happened. So eventually I make it back to my own family and I tell them this story. And they say, well, Nick, you've just called Hong Xiuzhu, the head of the Kuomintang party, which one implies that she's old.
Ooh.
Because she's your dad's older brother's wife.
Strike one.
Two, you've implied that she's married, but she's not.
Strike two.
And lastly, in Chinese politics, whenever somebody comes up to you and says, hey, we're family, people get a little suspicious. And so you going up to her and saying, hey, auntie, what's up? Probably wasn't going to work out, no matter what you said.
Strike out.
Oh, but I still have a picture. You know, she was the perfect example of the seasoned politician where we're both smiling and she's shaking my hand. And there's me looking absolutely unaware of what had just happened.
Well, you called the head of the party. It's like, hey, what's up, auntie, right?
Yeah.
Equivalent, right? Oh, that's pretty funny. Wow. Well, you know, Nick, I'm curious to know, like, you've definitely applied yourself. It's clear to me. You've really applied yourself to learn the language. And that's something I think a lot of people need to really understand. A lot of times you'll think, oh, heritage learners, they just grew up speaking Chinese. But it's not that simple, right? If you're really going to learn that language, you're going to really have to apply yourself to gain a higher level of proficiency. And in your case, specifically literacy as well.
Yeah. And to be honest, if I could give anybody a piece of advice. So my family were Buddhists. And in Buddhism, they talk about the middle path, right? You don't want to stray too far to either extreme. When you're learning Chinese, you don't want to give yourself too much pressure. Because you want to learn. You want to have fun, right? Being able to go to a restaurant, and even if your Chinese isn't very good, being able to point at something and say, I want this. And having the host or the hostess come respond to you with the affirmative, right? It's a powerful feeling, right? When I was in Taiwan and I hadn't learned how to read Chinese yet, I went up to a person running a stall and I was chatting with them, you know, hey, I'm from the States. I'm trying to learn Chinese. What do you sell here? The guy looked at me flabbergasted because in the wall behind him was everything that he was selling. And so it's rough, right? Having a conversation is enough. You can ask where the bathroom is and you can ask for directions, but there will always be one extra thing that if you just give yourself a little bit of an internal motivation, you could learn how to read Chinese, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And tell me about, like, how is Chinese a part of your life even today?
Well, it's helpful to know a different language because then you can engage with people, right? Right now where I work, I don't use my Chinese language as much, but the idea is that someday if I get to change jobs, I would want to do something that would utilize my Chinese. My partner, she works at a company that does sanctions. She goes through corporate records and she goes through, you know, legal documents to try to figure out the relationship between people that our government sanctioned and the companies that they own, right? And so in that case, you would use the language every single day. But for me right now, it's just being able to engage with people and having an opportunity to talk to people like you and share my experiences. And it's also kind of nice that when I go visit my parents and my grandparents, that we can have a conversation and people, for the most part, don't think that I'm out of place.
Oh, that's great. You know, in fact, actually, I'd like to hear just from your perspective, too. It's like you say you've learned some Taiwanese. How would you describe the difference between standard Mandarin versus Taiwanese?
So that's a great question, Jared, because there is Mandarin, right? There is Taiwanese Mandarin, and then there is Taiwanese. As is classic in everything Chinese, it's a little complicated.
Of course, of course.
So a lot of the Taiwanese people, other than the Aboriginal community in Taiwan, came from the Fujian region of China, and that's the southeastern coast.
For listeners, a little bit between Shanghai and Hong Kong.
Yeah. For part of that Fujian region, they speak Minnanese. And so because of the fact that Taiwan is just a couple hundred kilometers off of the coast of China, there were people moving from mainland China to Taiwan since the 1500s. And so the Taiwanese language that they speak is very similar to mainland. The difference, though, is that because of the fact that Taiwan has been consistently turned around, early on in their history, they were a Portuguese colony.
Mm-hmm.
And then they became a Dutch colony. That's why some people call Taiwan the island of Formosa.
Yes.
Which is Portuguese for a beautiful island. And then because of World War II and Japanese occupation, then they have Japanese influence.
Mm.
For example, in Minnanese, they would say motorcycle the regular way. But in Taiwan, a motorcycle is autobai, which sounds like autobike. And that's because when the Japanese were there, they called motorcycles autobai, which is because of American influence, right? Matthew Perry.
Oh, wow.
Another thing, too, is we would say pan, as in bread. And that's because of Portuguese. So If you want to eat rice, right? To give you an example of Taiwanese, jia beng is, it literally means to eat rice. But in conversation, it means it's time to eat. Or in another example is jia ba bui, which is a question of have you eaten? So if I said that statement in both the mainland and in Taiwan, I think most people would understand that. But there are some interesting, like, specific changes that make somebody immediately know whether or not you're from one side or another. And that's funny because back when the ROC was still fighting the PRC, that's how they would test people. If you were going to use ROC or Taiwanese language and not the mainland vocabulary, there is a subtle difference between Mandarin and Taiwanese because of vocabulary, but primarily because of pronunciation. So zh, ch, sh sounds.
Yeah.
And you might hear them in zhong, like in zhongguo, like in China. Or you might hear it in cha, drink tea. Or he shui, which is drink water. Because of the way that the language kind of evolved, the z, c, s and the zh, ch, sh differences kind of disappeared, right? And so when you go to Taiwan, you know, you want a glass of water, you might hear somebody say, he sui.
No, shui.
Yeah.
Sui.
Sui. Cha, not cha. And then when you say zhongguo, a person from Taiwan might say zhongguo, you lose the H. For those of us who know pinyin, you lose the H. Another example is xi yi fu, fu, as in washing clothes. Taiwanese people might say xi yi hu, so the f, the f sound becomes a h sound. And then...
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and then...
That's interesting to hear, because actually a lot of other regions around China, which are a little bit similar, that you drop the R's and you get L's and... There's no more SH, just S, things like that. And so it sounds like you have some of those dynamics going on there when we get into Taiwan. And of course, regional words and usage of words can vary from area to area. And it's the same with any country. It happens in America.
Yeah.
England's especially a huge offender when this dynamic comes into play. Well, that's really interesting. That's really cool. Well, you know, Nick, I think this has been really interesting. And I appreciate you sharing these stories. What gives me hope is that if you can go and embarrass yourself in front of almost a head of state, then there's still hope for me, right?
Yeah, 100%. And if I can just leave just one last kernel, my partner, she learned in high school, and then she went to the Hopkins Nanjing Center, and she also spent some time abroad. The one thing that you can really, really work on is your tones, right? Studying the language is great, but if you can master those tones, and if you can just kind of mold and shape it, that is where your Chinese will really shine. And so I am 100% an advocate for polishing those.
This episode brought to you by Tones. I agree with you. A big advocate. Well, Nick, thanks so much for coming here and sharing your story with us. I found it really interesting and insightful.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity. You know, shout out to Taiwan. It's great and a lot of history.
And right now, it's one of the few places you could actually go to visit, right?
Yeah.
Just because of the current COVID regulations. So yeah, hey, give a shout out to Taiwan, the beautiful isle. No, it's a garden isle. Isle garden. What is it? Beautiful isle?
Oh, it's a beautiful island, I think.
Beautiful island. Okay. Yeah. Taiwan, the beautiful island. You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, picnic maker, home baker, ticket taker, sleep faker, tree quaker, dressmaker, caretaker, icebreaker, troublemaker, and that one guy named Riker. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com or tag us on social media, hashtag mannercompanion. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and the interview editor is Dominic Edgley. I'd like to thank our guest interview, Nick Hung. And of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasley. See you next time.